I've got the things I wanted, plus a great big car. Every day I'm getting more popular. So use these magic words, they will see you right through. When you ain't feeling lucky and you don't know what to do, I said,
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's 1 o'clock and time for the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal, our public affairs here at WHFR.fm, the station making waves. It's the only local, truly local, radio talk show, news show, interpretive opinion show that we think is in this area. So we talk about Dearborn, the surrounding areas, and topics that maybe they do involve the whole country, but there are certain issues like healthcare that we've talked about for the last few weeks, trying to dispel rumors, calm fears, keep people on track. And I'm joined today in the studio by my co-host, Ned Apigian. So, Ned, how are you doing today?
Very good.
Well, that's a spirit.
If it stopped raining, I feel better.
Yeah, it was just sprinkling a little bit when I came in here. I wanted to ask you something about, maybe you know this, because of being a Dearborn Heights resident and actually being a contender for the Dearborn Heights City Council in November. Is that right? You're going to be on the ballot there?
Yeah, is that the Latinized version?
Contenda? That's the on the waterfront Marlon Brando version of the pronunciation, right?
Oh.
1954.
I better relook at that movie.
Yeah. No, I read a story, and maybe you're looking at it there, about Dearborn Heights, and that is that they have lost one council member. And they're thinking of, is it appointing another person? And they're having some difficulty doing that. Is that how they fill the spot? They just, the council appoints?
I haven't read the article yet, but about the, I know.
Apparently the person can't run for, in the next election. They're just filling the spot. And so that's one problem of trying to find them. See if we find the article, we'll come across it. But
my understanding, because it's happened twice before in my recollection, is that the sitting council can sit down together at a meeting and select somebody to fill a vacant seat till the next election period, which is not necessarily 2 years, but where election periods are usually in November, and they would be a special election. They don't do what the city of Dearborn does, which is they immediately fill a vacancy with the last runner-up, whoever that would be.
From the last election,
from the previous election. They claim, the politicians sitting say, because the election is bifurcated, which means in one
cut
period it's cut in two, there's three people elected, and then the next period four people are elected, that complicates the issue for their reasoning.
I see.
Doesn't for me, whoever was the last election, whoever was the
the most recent one, that would seem to be the way to do it. But,
that's right.
Well, we'll see if we run across that. Just a little catch-up here, and always appreciate email from our listeners to the new WHFR Journal. From Mary Jo, and she just wanted to point out that the nearest VA hospital, we were talking about how the fact that government-controlled health care with government-hired doctors and nurses is what they do for veterans. And so the VA hospital that formerly was in Allen Park has been replaced. These are her words. In other words, people in this area have to go now to the John D. Dingell. Wonder who helped get the bill passed to put money in for this new hospital, VA Medical Center, in 1996. Obviously, Mr. Dingell must have helped with that, or just been honored for his years of service. And, you know, as we mentioned on the show, it was his dad that put in a universal single-payer health care bill, introduced that in the 1940s. Of course, it hasn't been approved, wasn't approved, and Mr. Dingell is one of the key Democrats leading the fight for health care reform, which we continually state on this show and quote people like Mr. Dingell and Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. and yours truly and Nobel Prize winning economist, that is the way to go, to at least have a public option. At least have a public option. True, the public option will be so wonderful and so good that some health insurance companies will be out of business. Because people will choose them, the public option, because it's better in so many ways than the, let's call them, idiosyncrasies of the private, for-profit healthcare system, insurance system that we have now. Anyway, if you
actually, that's an interesting point, which is false, because they keep using the post office as an example of what happens when the government gets involved. They can't do anything right. Well, then how come the post office didn't put FedEx and UPS out of business? And I haven't heard anybody use that argument against those characters that say that.
Apparently, that's a profit-making thing, and they sort of, on purpose, the government decided not to compete in that arena, even though they do have packages, but they don't have a fleet of trucks enough, I guess, to do all the deliveries and do them overnight with had to buy planes and so on. So the I understand that the, and I talked on this show, too, about the $8 billion deficit in the U.S. postal system. For this year, that has to be made up somehow within a few months. I mean, they've got to figure out a new budget, and probably means higher cost of stamps, even though our price per
just went up.
First class just went up, but it's going to have to go up more. I doubt the government's going to be able to bail out the postal system, but we have one of the least expensive postal systems in terms of cost for us to mail a package or to mail a letter in the whole world.
Really?
So, Canada try to send a single first class letter, it's about two or three times the cost for a stamp over there that it is here.
Oh.
So we really have subsidized our postal system so much so that they're losing money now. And if we would have aggressively, as a government, my belief, and I'm not saying it's appropriate, but if we would have aggressively used all the people, all the facilities, and all the trucks we already have to get into the package business too, and they certainly could do more of that, they would start putting UPS and FedEx out of business. Even though the postal system is made up of union employees, unionized means they have good benefits and good pay. Some of FedEx and UPS, they may not be paid as well if they're not union. I'm not sure if they're union or not.
Oh.
I do know that the competition is fierce. Those little yellow trucks, what was it, UHL? There was another package delivery company from Europe that tried to get a foothold in America in the last
DHL,
year. DHL, right. And they're out of business here now.
Oh, they're out of business
now.
Yeah,
they can't. They couldn't make it economically. There was just, there's FedEx and UPS, and they've got established, routes.
There's
and so
something
on,
but about the post office. I don't think the average person realizes the post office is forced to do the kind of business that FedEx and UPS are not doing. They're delivering house to house daily mail.
Yeah, that's
they're handling the junk mail.
Right. That's where the cost is, because that's we got to have all the people, and so the costs are very high. The profit margin is very low, if there's any profit margin at all. And again, we're not paying enough for our postage rates to to compensate for that. So yeah, the government got involved in something that actually private business didn't want to get involved in. It wasn't feasible.
In all fairness to them, this has never been illustrated. I never hear that.
Right.
Other than me saying it now, I've never heard anybody else say
that. Well, I'm glad you came by today. So, but it's it's true, and it's a complicated situation. But you know who started the post office too?
Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin. Yep. I don't know if he was delivering mail himself, but it was a good idea. There's something again. I'm all over the place in terms of politics, and maybe that makes me inconsistent or. I don't know, scattered in my head, but some things I really do believe, and that all opinions on this show are not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford Community College, but I really do believe that some activities in this society are best done by the federal government. And
the military.
Obviously, you can't get I mean, it's got to be, the military, even though it's interesting that we have several militaries. I mean, we have state militias and we have local police.
And private militias now, right. With black, black.
So just to be careful that there wouldn't be a military state that could happen in an easy coup, we actually have several different levels and different organizations that are involved in different activities, which is why it was so hard to get sort of Homeland Security organized. It's still not organized because there's so many different agencies, not the same one. Now, I'm not in favor of uniting all police and military into one thing. I think that would be going too far. But some things like, folks, healthcare, yes, I do believe we should consider it as a right, the so-called pursuit of liberty and happiness and all that in the Declaration of Independence. How is that possible if you're sick and you can't afford to get treatment? How is that possible, to plan your life and have to take a job, let's say, just to pay for your health care insurance, and it's a job you don't like? You don't even believe in the product or service but you got to have the job to pay for the health care so you can actually have a life that's healthy enough to maybe, I don't know, go to a movie once a week or something, just to. So it's I personally feel that we've got to have major healthcare reform, and the public option or universal single payer phased in through Medicare, perhaps, it's got to happen. No, it won't bankrupt us. It'll be cheaper in the long run, in terms of what we pay, and you don't trust me. You can believe our Nobel Prize winning. Often quoted columnist here for the New York Times, Paul Krugman, and Thomas Friedman too, who both state the same thing. By the way, if you are a VA person and you need medical assistance, the John Dingell VA Medical Center is and has been since '96 located 4646 John R Street near the Detroit Medical Center. So that's right next to the DMC, and I haven't been down there, but John R. Street, downtown Detroit.
Warren and John R., I think they butt together.
Okay, yeah, maybe. So thank you, Mary Jo, for that.
What's interesting about what we were saying, and I asked somebody, I went to a congressional birthday party yesterday. The lies that they say about what's not in the program is okay. It's not illegal to lie about something. That's extremely interesting.
Right. I've said that on the show, and it boggles even some of my students when they, we talk about TV commercials or whatever in an intro telecom class here, and they think, it couldn't be on television if it wasn't true. Well, okay, there is a Food and Drug Administration, FDA, that does regulate what people say in their commercials, private companies say in their commercials about the efficacy, how well they work, of their products. And they require them either to pay fines for violation or do makeups. That means they're forced to create commercials to undo the mistaken impressions that were stated earlier. And that goes on a regular basis, but that's not exactly, they do allow slanting and, partial truths. And in fact, in our society, the only place it's clearly that lying is made illegal is in a courtroom when you raise your hand and swear on the Bible that you'll tell the truth. And then they can prosecute you in various ways if you're found to have lied.
In front of Congress, too.
Right, yeah. There's some committees testifying in front of Congress that you also have to take that pledge. But everywhere else, you can lie. And of course, you can have crazy opinions. I mean, you can have opinions that are not based on the facts. And, you know, the health care bill is still being written. There's several different versions in the House, several different versions in the Senate in Washington, D.C. And so it is hard to say exactly what's in it or not because it's not done yet.
Yeah, but it's not a single-payer government-run program. And they have people stand up and say, I'm against a government-run program. And the congressman standing in front of the crowd doesn't stop and say, this is not even a proposal. So when Barney Frank says, what planet do you spend most of your time on? You would think somebody would say, that is not an issue. So why? And everybody's somebody's sending out that message and they're all parroting the same thing. Right. That's what bothers me about it. Otherwise, they can say, they can slant issues if they want. Hmm?
So here's the comment from Paul Krugman from New York Times. This Monday, it's this week, folks, and it's exactly what Ned was talking about on the show. We try to do what's called in the radio business segues. That means we try to do transitions. So whenever we touch
smoothly
on something, not so smoothly, but so Paul Krugman in the New York Times said this, and his article is entitled Return of the Zombies. He says, the debate over the public option, so-called, in healthcare has been dismaying in many ways. Perhaps the most depressing aspect for progressives, however, has been the extent to which opponents of greater choice in healthcare have gained traction in Congress, if not with the broader public, simply by repeating over and over again that the public option would be horrors, a government program. Washington, it seems, is still ruled by Reaganism, or that's Reaganism. Reaganism, by an ideology that says government intervention is always bad. Always bad. And, of course, it's not always bad, folks.
By definition.
It hasn't been bad. People love the Social Security they have. People love the Medicare and Medicaid they have. People are fairly well satisfied with our military, considering the kinds of wars we got them into. Yeah, as long as they don't have to go. And so, we have wonderful government program. We already have an organization. We are not a pure democracy. We are not pure capitalism. We are about 30% socialism, and we love it. We have loved it since the 1930s in one way or the other.
You just don't call it that.
Right. Yeah. Well, they do if you take a political science class. They say, look, we're pretty much a socialized, democratic socialism or whatever you want to call it. Right. We are not quite as far along as countries like Sweden, primarily because we don't have the universal single-payer health care that they do that works so well for them. And they believe it's, as people in Canada do, it's a birthright. It's a birthright, and it's...
Well, Lafayette, what was his? La Follette, the socialist candidate for president at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
Almost everything he proposed then is now adopted in what we're doing.
Yeah, and I don't want to scare people because they're, but...
It's a scary word.
Karl Marx, a lot of people know that he came up with the first ideas and coined the term communism, a different economic system, and he and... Frederick Engels, 1854, they wrote something called, a small pamphlet called the Communist Manifesto.
Das Kapital was another one.
Well, that's a big book that I don't think anybody read later. But and in this brief pamphlet, the Communist Manifesto, if I remember my history classes and political science classes correctly, there was a 10-point program for the economic changes that needed to come about in order to get communism. 9 of those 10 principles have already been established.
In
the United States of America. Why? Because they were good, democratic, equitable changes. The only one that hasn't come about, and I don't suspect it ever will, not even under socialism, is complete ownership of all property by the government. You say, slippery slope.
That's not going to happen.
I don't think it'll happen. I mean, that's too much like a dictatorship, a tyranny. I don't think that'll happen in the U.S. It hasn't happened in Germany. It hasn't happened in France, Canada. Hasn't happened in Sweden. All these other places have universal health care. They don't have communism. Okay, they don't have complete government ownership of all property, and so we're not going to either. There's no slippery slope.
And they don't have it in China.
Right. So. all of the other things, I mean, those 9 out of 10 parts of the Communist Manifesto, they were kind of like socialism, okay? They were federal principles, national governmental principles, and I won't go into them here. Look it up, folks. The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx, not Groucho, M-A-R-X, and Frederick Engels, E-N-G-E-L-S.
Who was a successful rich capitalist.
Yes, right, he was. I don't think Marx was too successful,
no.
But
no.
Engels knew what the elite were all about
because
he was part of the system, yeah. Okay, let me just finish this thing from Paul Krugman, this editorial from the New York Times. He said, call me naive, but I actually hope that the failure of Reaganism in practice, you know, the trickle-down theory, Ned, you know, that was so discredited. I mean, nobody believes that giving tax cuts to the rich will cause the rich to hire more workers and put all the money back in investing in their companies. Doesn't happen, folks. The rich seem to just get richer. And it's totally been proven the last 20 years that, and yet, you know, our last president, George W., you know, tax cuts for the rich. Oh, that'll stimulate the economy. It didn't under Reagan, and it didn't under Bush. Of course, he got involved in a couple of big wars and all kinds of things that weren't funded, that we had no money for. So we just had to borrow ourselves deeper in debt. But the tax cut for the rich doesn't work, never has worked. It was part of Reaganism. And even George Bush the first president, George Bush, George W.'s father, before he was Reagan's VP, when he was, you know, in the nominating process, that's trying right. to be president instead of Reagan, he called it voodoo economics.
That's right.
That's not going to work.
And nobody remembers too much what he said. Two things that got him in trouble. He called that voodoo economics. He was right. Second thing was, which didn't help him, he was against giving money to Israel for the funding of mortgages, properties, if you remember.
Mm.
He went on the limb with that issue. And the third one was, read my lips, new taxes. Yeah. Well, the problem with taxes was Reagan and those people cut them down to a level where you... to restore taxes back to the previous level where you could operate government.
Yes, there wasn't enough money.
Is the issue, and the whole issue is to starve government. So if you starve government, government can't afford the programs that we're talking about.
And in terms of the size of governmental bureaucracy, it like doubled under Reagan. I mean, he had, you know, campaigning, small government, and we'll get government down in size. Well, it doubled or tripled. Again, it was unbelievable how many more agencies, how many more people were hired.
Not to mention the deficit.
Right. Not to mention the deficit, which wasn't being helped by the voodoo economics. Anyway, as Paul Krugman says, Reaganism in practice wasn't killed. It turns out, however, to be a zombie doctrine. You know, all those Living Dead movies. Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting term in Canada. Since we may have Canadian listeners.
Yes, I think we do.
During the Second World War, the Canadians had a very interesting system. Even if you were drafted into the army, if you were married with children, you definitely were not going to go overseas, which seemed to be an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you, even though you qualified as a single eligible young male, they asked you if you wanted to go. If you didn't want to go, they line you up and they said, step one, step forward. And if you didn't, they called the guys that didn't zombies.
Oh, I see.
It's interesting. Only octogenarians and septuagenarians
sort of
may remember in Canada.
Mindless drones or something.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Ned Apikian, always filling us in on history, like his Then and Now show, which was on last week on our forum program. Krugman goes on to say, he says, first of all, even before the current crisis, Reaganomics had failed to deliver what it promised. And then there's a small matter of the worst recession since the 1930s. There's a lot to be said about the financial disaster of the last 2 years, but the short version is simple. Politicians, in the thrall of Reaganite ideology, dismantled the New Deal regulations that had prevented banking crises for half a century, believing that financial markets could take care of themselves. And I will say that Bill Clinton and some of the Democrats under him also contributed to bills that undid these sort of regulations that
the
would have
Republican-controlled Congress.
Well, that was the main idea, but a lot of Democrats went along with it, and Clinton signed it into effect in the or the early 90s. Anyway, Krugman goes on, the effect was to make the financial system vulnerable to a 1930s-style crisis, and the crisis came. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1937, is quoted here, and Roosevelt said, our President Roosevelt, okay, not Teddy, Franklin, quote, we have always known that heedless self-interest is bad morals. Get that, folks. Think about that. Heedless self-interest is bad morals. That's the way it goes. Heedless self-interest equals bad morals, I'd say. Make it even more direct. We now know that it is bad economics, too, said Franklin Roosevelt. Okay? So, you know, of course, he was believed that big government could save us, and it did do a lot of things.
He was the traitor to his class, but he saved capitalism in America.
There you go. And he said, last year we learned that lesson all over again, according to Krugman. Or did we? Says Krugman. The debate over the public option, that's healthcare thing, right, folks, has, as I said, been depressing in its inanity. Inanity. Something that is inane is just so stupid.
Is that what he said?
You can't even think about it. Yeah.
Repeat that. That's too interesting.
Okay, the debate over the public option has, as I said, been depressing in its inanity.
There you go.
He said, but it's much the same on other fronts. Efforts to strengthen bank regulation appear to be losing steam as opponents of reform declare that more regulation would lead to less financial innovation. Yeah, like there was financial innovation leading up to this. Yeah, financial innovation that was corrupt at its core.
They were gambling with other people's money that was...
with no safety net, yeah. Just months after the wonders of innovation, as I just said, brought our financial system to the edge of collapse, a collapse that was averted only with huge infusions of taxpayer funds. So why don't these zombie ideas die? He concludes by answering that, and he says, part of the answer is that there's a lot of money behind them. But some of the blame must also rest with President Obama, who famously praised Reagan during the Democratic primary and hasn't used the bully pulpit, that is the power of the presidency, to speak out to confront government is bad fundamentalism. Okay? He says that's ironic in a way, since a large part of what made Reagan so effective, for better or for worse, was the fact that he sought to change America's thinking as well as his tax code. And his last sentence is, it's hard to avoid the sense that a crucial opportunity is being missed and we're at what should be a turning point but are failing to make the turn. I hope we can somehow. The debate will start up again after Labor Day in Congress. And if you folks out there want to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem, you need to write your representatives and let them know. Send emails, go on the internet, make phone calls to their local offices. By the way, Ned was saying there's no single-payer universal health care bill. John Conyers, our own rep here in East Dearborn in Detroit, he has such a bill, H.R. 676, I believe. It's just not out of committee, you know, because the other Democrats have said, we don't want that kind of thing.
Obama claimed he didn't want such a thing.
Right. The public option is different. That's just a competition. It does not eventually, unless the competition is too great and the private health insurance companies go out of business over the next 20, 50 years.
But the public option is for people who lose their jobs, the people that are who are not employed or underemployed. Right. And the whole idea is that the insurance companies are, in order to compete with that, will therefore reduce their rates. Mm-hmm. And then the law is going to say you cannot use if you're, your ailments from the past.
Right, pre-existing conditions.
Pre-existing conditions, they can't cut you off. So all the people that have insurance, who are 80% of the population, are not realizing that the public option purpose is to guarantee that your insurance doesn't rise and rise and rise, mm-hmm. and that you can't be cut off, and that you can leave your job and move to another job. Those things are in your interest. Instead of winding everybody up about the public option that may not concern them at all, they don't have to. You can keep the policy you have. It's only mm-hmm. going to get better, and it's going to get cheaper.
And although some people, even who live in Canada, France, Germany, Sweden, you can find some people, England, who don't like their healthcare system, the vast, vast majority like it better than what we like, our system over here. And of course, you think, as I've said on the show before, you may think you love your health care insurance that you have now. You may love your doctor and so on.
Wait till you got a problem and they don't pay.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I had the other twist and turn, which I've said before, that 5 years ago, I had a health problem, and I was feeling dizzy, so I went in the hospital. I won't mention which one. And the doctors basically exaggerated and lied to me about the nature of my condition, saying I had no choice but a $100,000 option on my heart. It was a success, thank goodness. But it just so happened this hospital just opened a new coronary wing, as they call it, a new heart care operating room, and nobody was in it. So they're losing money every second on this multi-million dollar facility. So they saw, oh, Koronic has Blue Cross Blue Shield, complete coverage. Well, let's tell him he's got a major health problem, and the only answer is, quad bypass. Okay. Well, thank you very much. But in my health records, it shows I didn't need the quad bypass, but I got it, and now I have a pre-existing condition. According to the fact I just had the operation, if I tried to get health care insurance somewhere else, I probably couldn't get it.
You're a time
bomb. Oh, he has a major heart problem. Even though I'm on no drugs, I can jog and run. I'm just fine. Who knows about tomorrow? But I'm just saying is
that... You got some good plumbing now.
Yeah. Well, I've got different plumbing now, and it seems to be holding up. But that's not the point. I didn't need the operation, even by doctoring standards. I switched doctors to a doctor that said, no, according to your charts, according to the tests they did at the time, didn't need it. So somebody paid for that $100,000 operation. Somebody got the benefit. I know $25,000 went to the surgeon for 3.5 hours of cutting into me.
Ooh, that's a good job.
Yeah, he does 4 or 5 of those a day.
A day?
Yeah, 4 or 5 a day. He's in there digging in people's chests. He's 25 years old, my particular doctor, so he's a wunderkind with a God complex, and thank God he does have that God because he knows what he's doing, I guess. But the point is, I wasn't near death. I didn't need that opera. There was other things they could have done, and I would have been just fine.
Well, that's the point they're making in this.
But now
thing.
I can't get health insurance. Now that I'm retired, I lost all my care that was part of my full-time job. I'm on a state plan now. Luckily, I'm able to get the state plan, and it's just not that good. It's not that doesn't give me that much coverage, and so I'm waiting for Medicaid, when I turn 65, to maybe cover me a little more.
Maybe Medicare, not Medicaid.
Whatever happens at 65, yes.
Medicare.
Okay, Medicare.
Medicare. Ned knows. For he's, old, poor people.
Yeah, Ned's extremely old. No, he's very young, actually, in his
But
in his mind.
I'm surprised the teachers can't maintain their health program.
No, we have retirement money from the state as well as Social Security, and that's nice. But teachers, you're totally really cut off. You're forced to a very, very second-rate, although I would call it third- or fourth-rate healthcare insurance plan, which is guaranteed if you're a teacher. I mean, you got to get it. Pre-existing condition
doesn't... You don't have to buy a supplement?
I could.
You don't need to buy a supplement.
Well, I haven't explored that
good
yet.
Enough,
I'm still just trying to pay the payments from the office visits that are... Until I get to a deductible, I'm paying every penny, So it's not a copay, it's a deductible thing. This is Blue Cross Blue Shield's special retired teacher plan, which still
costs
me.
That's the whole problem. Well, there are 1,700 health insurance companies, and each one of them have more plans than you can count on your fingers and toes.
Yeah.
Imagine the complexity of that.
Well, it's just like the, is it Medicare Part D, which is the drug thing? How can you even figure that out? There's so many competing plans. They change every year, and if you don't keep up on the changes each year, and then you have a window of opportunity.
It's only in January, and a certain date you can change from one to another. That's another thing.
You may find that your plan has gone up in money, and you need to change, but how do you explore and research this? Now, there's some websites. I don't know. Ned, what do you do?
The thing about it that's interesting, and I don't have that problem. My plan is better than that. You will find the company you pick has the prescription you're using today.
Well, that's what you got to...
But they may change next year, not cover that prescription. You may change a prescription on a plan and find out the company you have now doesn't cover it. And this is the complexity this, the Republican Congress gave us 4 years ago that's just unbelievable, not to mention the donut hole. But I'll say one thing about the donut hole is not that bad, because I found out for myself, you barely reach the donut hole of $2,500, that the value of what you've exhausted. And then it starts all over again in January. So unless you're very, very sick and you have complicated medical situations, that donut hole won't affect most people. I would guess at least 75% of people.
Well, so I don't think
my Democratic friends that keep hollering about the donut hole, I don't think it really affects too many people.
But it's still quite a confusion to try to figure out which is the best plan for you.
Whichever plan you pick, the problem is they change the medications.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they also are now, because of competition, they're charged a monthly fee. Mm-hmm. And because of the competition, some of them are not charging that fee. Mine, theoretically, is $27.90 a month. Mm-hmm. But I'm in a HMO, so all this doesn't mean anything to me. My HMO doesn't recognize the donut hole, and it's not a problem. I just pay $15 for every doctor visit and $30 for every specialist.
And also, when they passed this law to create Medicare Part D for the prescription drug coverage,
you don't have to take it either.
The government did not negotiate. The government promised not to negotiate lower drug prices from the government to the drug companies. In other words, they can still do whatever the heck they want to in setting the prices. And we know that if you had to buy them retail in the U.S. compared to a person buying them retail, the same drug, the same quality, the same manufacturer in Canada, it's about half to a third as much in Canada for the same drug. And we're not talking Canadian money versus U.S. We're talking about equitable amounts of cash here. It's less. And why? Because the drug companies, well, maybe people aren't as rich in Canada.
It's because of the lobbyists in the United States.
Right.
The problem with lobbyists is they made a deal and actually wrote into the thing that you can't do what the VA does, negotiate for prices. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So, it was a terrible bill, and AARP endorsed it in Congress. They said, well, it's better to get something than nothing.
That's true, I guess.
Well, we got a long way to go before we really get something that should be the way it is, even for prescription drug coverage this is for seniors, right? For people already on Medicaid or Medicare?
You have to be on Medicare, right?
Already.
You can't get, it's like buying Part B. You have to buy Part B, but you have to buy Part D.
Okay.
They give you Part A.
And how do you get on Medicare?
You have to be 65.
Oh, 65.
Now it's not like that, because now you're getting Social Security at 65 plus so many months. So when you actually get on the program, I think that's when it begins. They give you Part A. You do not pay a penny for it. It so-called covers the hospital expenses. Mm-hmm. Part B is the physician's expenses. And Part B, they deduct out of your Social Security check $98.50 for you, for your wife, every month. You don't see it. And then it only covers 80% of the expenditures. That's why you have to buy a supplement, either for Blue Cross or any one of these companies, to cover the remaining 20%. And it depends on the policy you buy, how good it is.
Think things have to be like this. They don't have to be that complicated. Just like I've proposed, and we had a guest here, for people to consider the fair tax, which is supported by a lot of people, not just some conservatives, Republicans, and all libertarians. The fair tax actually it would raise the same amount of money that's raised now, but it would do away with the IRS totally, because it's a consumption tax, okay? All across the U.S., everything you buy would have a fairly large tax applied. It's talked about between 23 and 30%.
Okay? How about if you bought a house? Is that considered?
Yep. Mm-hmm. But in your paycheck, which most people don't realize, the withholding is about 30% of most people's paychecks. So there's 30% of your money you don't even see from week to week if you have a job and it's not under the table pay. And so it will not only balance out, but what it gives you is a total besides doing away with income tax preparation with all loopholes.
How about state? Then there's no state tax then? The state gets money from the federal government?
The state still has to figure out what it wants to do. So
oh,
it could add a fair tax.
They can't share in it.
The state could do a fair tax now instead of the income tax. And the point is that, well, like some people, like Lou Dobbs people say, hey, even illegal immigrants here would have to pay that tax because they have to buy stuff, you know.
Yeah, well.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I wanted to feature now sort of a promo for the talk show that we call the WHFR Forum that's on every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. and also available for podcast. Tomorrow, which is the fifth Saturday of the month, we don't have a regular show from month-to-month schedule. So once every 3 months or so, we have a fifth Saturday. And so I'm going to be playing back a program called This Week in Science. Now, it's produced by a college radio station, but it's the University of California Davis campus. And it's hosted by Dr. Kirsten Sanford. She's a PhD neurophysicist. That's the physics of the mind, okay, and how the brain works and so on. And a good communicator. And then she's got this guy who likes science called Justin. And he's a little bit of a strange person. But and he's always making some silly comments. But it's very much a college radio kind of show. And they got into this week. What I'm going to do is right now is play a segment. And you can hear all of it tomorrow on WHFR from 10 to 11 a.m. or check the podcast under Forum anytime after 11 a.m. tomorrow. It'll be on our website, whfr.fm. You can hear the whole show. Now, we only feature
click
this
Forum
every now and then. The reason I'm playing this segment right now is in the middle of their show for this week that was broadcast out there in California on Tuesday. They talk actually about health care. And in the midst of this, they get a phone call from a listener in Sweden. Or is it Denmark? Anyway, all the way, that's the beauty of the internet, just like WHFR, you can listen all around the world, and maybe some of you are, they get this phone call, which they answer right in the studio. And so listen about 5-6 minutes here to a segment from what's called This Week in Science. If you want to know more about the show, you can actually go to iTunes and get it yourself every week regularly for free. Or go to their website, TWIS, thisweekinscience.org. Well, take a listen. This Week in Science here on the new WHFR Journal. And what is today? August 28th, 2009.
To be high, very high in the collapsed colonies. So it's a very good observation. It's good that they've figured that out. It actually might make... I mean, the more information you have, the better it is to tackle, easier it is to tackle a problem.
This, again, though, is it's indicative of a problem, maybe, but because you can't find a single thing that's
the mechanism's
wrong, that's
a little tougher.
Right. Yeah. So this is a symptom, but not the actual problem. There is probably something that is decreasing their immune response, something that's suppressing it in some way to allow them to have these higher parasite, these higher disease loads, but nobody knows what that is.
Yeah, it's some kind of B AIDS that, I mean, they haven't found that yet, but
right.
That's what, that's the appearance of it.
It's what it seems like, all the secondary
causes are getting to take advantage of the B.
And that's probably a lot. I mean, it's something compromises the bees. The bees get really sick. They have these high levels of disease, parasite, whatever, and then the colony collapses because it can't take it.
Right.
And so, there's something upstream that we haven't found yet, and until we do, this is going to be a significant problem, and it could potentially hugely impact our agriculture, especially in states like here in California.
Yeah, if the bees collapse, and then the agriculture will collapse after. I mean, it will follow pretty quickly. Pretty quickly, we need our bees. We need to have a bee telethon.
A bee telethon.
You know, raise some money for...
Instead of muscular dystrophy, we'll raise money for the bees.
Yeah, we need to cure these bees. I'm getting nervous.
No. There are people working on it.
Okay.
Scientists are working on it.
Okay, I'm cool. Just want to make sure somebody was in the lab.
That's right.
You know, had the Bunsen burners burning on this one.
We got the scientists in the lab with the bees. And the world's smallest laser.
Pew, pew, pew.
Is that the sound of the world's smallest laser? Yeah. So, okay, laser, acronym for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Mm. Yes. Well, this new world's smallest laser is called a spaser.
Because it's small?
No, because it generates radiation that's called surface plasmon. So surface plasmon amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I'm guessing here. And these surface plasmon lasers, spasers, which I just kind of I just want to hear, you know, Dr. Evil, it's my spaser. You know, I don't know. Sharks with spasers. I'm just going bad places. I don't know. This could bring us an entirely new, faster generation of computers, of electronics. It could take the place of many optical electronics that we currently have, transistors, silicon chips. So this laser, what they're doing, researchers have been working for a while on nano lasers, nanophotonics. The problem with using light normally is you have a limit to how small you can get and how small of an effect you can have that's limited to half of a wavelength of whatever frequency light you're using. But with these spasers, what they're doing is they're actually using light to activate these surface wave functions that occur within the surface of a metallic of a metal. So what they've done is they've and a non-reactive metal at that. So they've taken gold and they use these little tiny mirrors and these and very and let's see what they have. They're coating the gold with a layer of silica embedded in the dye that is a gain, acts as a gain function. And then the light gets confined to the surface of the gold as a plasmon. And then it can leave it. And then if that plasmon is activated and multiplied, and they use mirrors to amplify this signal, they can actually get photons to escape the surface of the gold that are within the visible light range. And so it kind of acts like a laser, but it can be really, really tiny. And so by making it much smaller than what's normally used and decreasing the space between reflective surfaces, we can actually fit these spasers into areas as small as 1 nanometer.
Oh my goodness.
It's tiny. Until now, the smallest nano laser that's been produced is about 100 nanometers wide, and this is actually the very smallest at 1 nanometer. And so this, because of the size, it works faster than normal transistors. It's going to, you could build amplifiers, logic elements, so says the professor of physics, Mark Stockman, who's been working on this at Georgia State University. Microprocessors working about 1,000 times faster than conventional silicon-based microprocessors. Mm-hmm. If you just think about all the applications that could be affected by decreasing the size of your transistor.
Well, I hope you're learning a lot about science. That's just a taste of how they go back and forth. And Dr. Her nickname on her Twitter account is Dr. Kiki. How they go back and forth and talk about science issues. And if you're interested in science, and boy, if you're not, you should be, because science is going to provide us with the answers we need to get out of our pollution, our energy problems. And by all means, we should pay more attention to the scientists. And so this is an interesting show. It is it's a college style production, sort of like Ned and I sitting here. You know, I thought I had the right segment queued up to include that phone call from Denmark, but I didn't hear it. So that's the way it goes. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. In fact, at the end, it's a very humorous ending. They have a little technical problem at the end of This Week in Science. So you'll hear that tomorrow on our WHFR forum from 10 to 11, and hope it's good infotainment and understand it's definitely a college radio style of production, non-commercial radio station, Dr. Sanford and Justin are doing it for free, basically, you know, just like Ned is here. Mm-hmm. And, well, that's the way it goes. So we have a couple more stories before the end of the hour. Yes, and Ned is now on. He can talk again.
Well, I was talking before, but you couldn't hear me.
Sorry.
The thing needed to be switched on.
Yes, the thingy, yes.
The thingy.
And even Justin and Dr. Sanford, they talk that back and forth, too. They said, hit the button.
Well,
they help each other, you know, but I think it's hilarious. Well, Governor Granholm was in town this week here in Dearborn. There's a picture of her on the cover of, on the front page of the Press and Guide from Wednesday, August 26th. She's standing at the train station showing a ticket. She actually paid a ticket, I guess, to ride from Ann Arbor to Detroit. And, of course, we are hoping for a new train station. We are hoping that... not only will it be an intermodal train station that buses and bicyclists and pedestrians, everybody can access it in and out quite easily.
Intermodal. That's
intermodal, it's
means?
Called.
Oh,
yes, right.
All you different, can bring your bike on the train.
A transportation hub, really. You know, a location where all kinds of transportation can easily exchange passengers back and forth. So taxi stands and light rail and little SEMTA buses, you know, and big buses.
When is it going to happen?
Well, they've got to raise a 10, 20, 30, I think it's $30 million. But they're going to get into a heavy-duty daily commuting schedule from Ann Arbor
to
next fall.
To
Detroit,
here
Ann Arbor, Detroit. Yeah.
So there'll be a bus from here to take you anywhere else from, like, to the shopping center?
Well, yeah, right. It's but the new station will have to be built in about 5 to 8 years. It'll be in West Dearborn, sort of where the Lincoln Mercury dealer is now. There's some land just west of the Lincoln Mercury dealer on Michigan Avenue there that they're thinking of moving the train station to. One of the reasons they have to move it is because of the possibility now, just like the Press and Guide headline, high-speed rail here. We're talking about trains that go an average of 110 miles an hour. How fast would it take to get to Ann Arbor that way? Whoa. Yeah, you're figuring out 40 miles.
I can drive there in 35 minutes.
Well, this will be faster. Well, you must have a shortcut, Ned, or go over the limit for that. So we have some stimulus money coming in, and it hasn't been finally chopped up, but the Midwest wants this new high-speed rail connection line, Detroit, Chicago, up into Wisconsin even, and it looks like they'll get a portion of the money. Now,
So Dearborn will be the Detroit stop?
Well, there will be a Detroit station, but
we'll be
depending on how we build it, our plans are way ahead. No, the old station is gone. That's not going to be renovated, no.
The track, I'm not talking about renovating the building. The location is there and the track is there.
Right. They're going to go right past that location. That's not in the plans that I've heard about. Detroit will, if it has some money, try to build its end station where
downtown
where the connection is now downtown. But Dearborn, hopefully, will have the biggest station with all the interconnections needed way before Detroit will. Just because we may have the money and we already have sort of a...
Southfield Freeway heads
right.
north.
We have a big hub here already, yes. And the definitely high-speed rail from the airport into Dearborn. So we get a lot of
customers. So this train is going to go to the airport and stop?
There's going to be a new station at the airport, too, so that you won't have to be kind of trapped right now. If you want to get to the airport to Dearborn, Metro Airport to Dearborn or Detroit,
you have to drive.
A taxi, yeah.
Or
drive your own car, right. So we've needed a high-speed rail or even a slow-speed rail connection with Metro Airport for years and years.
And then you could take those two ridiculous parking garages and move them over there because you'll need them there. You won't need them where they are.
They're a little bit further west of where the train station's going to be.
I'm just joking.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's the jokes for the day, folks. But okay. By the way, this other plan that Mayor O'Reilly has had a little bit of a PR setback here. There was a plan to have a new Fairlane Town Center conference center. In other words, around the Fairlane Town Center, shopping center that we have next to Henry Ford Community College here.
We have land.
There would be built, if they can raise the money, a conference facility next to the Hyatt Regency, too. But it would be the money doesn't come from the Hyatt that much.
They have residual land there for development.
Right,
that's
they
what
do.
It was established.
And so big numbers of people might come here and have their conference in this location, maybe via high-speed rail or whatever, that wouldn't come to this area before, because even though we have the hotels, we don't have all the meeting rooms. We don't have the auditoriums for, you know, a lot of discussions, a lot of individual presentations. Like, I would guess people like the American Medical Association, they would need maybe 120 separate meeting rooms, classroom-type areas at the same time, you know, to present all of their sessions over 4 or 5 days. So we don't have conference facilities that would really attract large numbers of conventions here yet, and we could become real competitive to downtown Detroit, which isn't doing much conference business anymore,
too. Well, downtown Detroit doesn't have that either. I know I went to American Institute of Architects convention mm-hmm. in Chicago. And you're right. There are sundry seminars and several rooms going on at the same time you had to sign up for.
But
can't do that at Cobo. There ain't that many rooms. I was involved with the design of the expansion. There aren't that many meeting rooms.
Not really. No, really not. The bad PR here, it's a minor setback, so we just wanted to correct the impression, or at least give Mayor O'Reilly's point of view on this, is that the Hyatt Regency is broke.
It is.
In Dearborn, yeah. That the property, first of all, lost $10.9 million in value, but all property has gone down in value around here. But their business has declined. That's a 14-story building, 772 rooms. And in June, the company that owns Hyatt Regency, it's called Ashford Hospitality Trust Incorporated, they stopped making payments on the almost $30 million mortgage that matures next year, actually. April 2010, they could have owned the Hyatt Regency building and property.
I thought Ford Land Development and Topman owned the building.
No, it's totally...
But then Ford Land Development holds the mortgage.
Well, maybe they do. I don't say who they're paying the mortgage to, but they would have owned the Hyatt and all the property free and clear. But they next April 2010, but they have stopped paying payments on the mortgage since April of this year.
They could catch up if they wanted to.
Right, and it says that the lender, whoever that bank is, issued a notice of default. You're behind in your payments for that Hyatt Regency building, and however, they do respond here, and the mayor would respond too. It says we have a way of dipping into some cash, and we won't foreclose or lose the Hyatt Regency. And the mayor says that maybe it's just another reason to get that conference center built. You know, it'll bring more business in to help fill up those 772 rooms and the other hotels nearby.
Well, let's conclude with the program we were talking about, the vacancy at Dearborn Heights. It
Go
says
ahead. Mm-hmm.
Applications being accepted for council vacancy. Today is the final day, the date of this newspaper, which was Wednesday, and that date was August 26th. I remember the date. Mm-hmm. The final today is the final day to submit an application to fill the vacancy for city council seat left open by the unexpected resignation of Bob Brown in July. And if early submittals are any indication, it might not be much of a contest. As of press time, only one person, Darlene Kresh, had submitted the paperwork despite the position being posted for more than 3 weeks. To be considered, applicants must submit a letter of interest stating the reasons for consideration, along with a resume including educational background, work history, and any public service experience. The candidates or candidate then will get a chance to state their case to the remaining 6 council members September 1st. 1 week later, the body will make its final decision at its regularly scheduled meeting. A majority must approve the candidate in order for the person to be sworn in. That's 4 votes out of 6. The selected candidate will be ensconced until the next council election in November, which is this coming November 2010. Brown, who cited his work as executive director of the Senior Alliance as his reason for resignation, would have been in office until December 31st, 2011.
Okay, we got that one straight. Thank you, Ned. A couple other ideas here just to share with you. You might think, hey, global warming, it doesn't exist, right? It's so cool in Michigan, and it was like 59 when I came in this afternoon.
This morning.
After 12. No, it was after 12, at least according to my car, it was 59 degrees. The sun is coming out now and probably get a little warmer this afternoon, but it's going to be cool. A report just came out from the National Wildlife Federation, combined with the Physicians for Social Responsibility. Big, big report looking all across the U.S., and it says that future U.S. heat waves will be much worse, and that there's terrible consequences of the fact that average temperatures are expected to grow 4 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit nationwide over the next century. But the severity has to do with a number of factors, and it's not so much the average temperature going up, which will cause problems, of course, for wildlife and vegetation and so on. It's also these extreme heat waves, you know, when it goes above average for a few days a year. For example, I have friends in Austin, Texas, and they've had temperatures above 100 degrees almost consistently since May.
I heard that.
And this is Austin. Now, I was drawn to this report, and you can go to National Wildlife Federation and go to their website, .org, and you can find this out. Detroit is in the second tier, about in the middle, about 15th, of the cities that will have extreme heat risk factors over the next years, and it's only going to get worse. Austin, Texas, and I already know that they're much further south and they're going to be in trouble. They are, I think, about 12th, and we're 15th. Now, why is Detroit going to have such a high risk?
It's not that near a lot of water, I think.
Well, it's a fact that percent of households without central air conditioning is 39%. 39% of our people don't have central air in this area, and so the higher temperatures will really affect them. Whereas in Austin, there's only 8% that don't have central air.
I'm surprised there's that many.
Right, I know. And ground level ozone, that's our atmosphere. We're very polluted here. Think industrial and carbon dioxide from the cars and industrial pollution. 82 parts per billion compared to Austin, which is only 78. So we have all this pollution. And what about people's resources? We have 34% of households below the poverty line in this metro area, 34%. Compared to Austin, it's only 18%. So the high risk comes in not just because of our pollution and the number of days of high temperature, but people don't have the air conditioners. They can't afford air conditioners even.
The economic status.
And they can't afford health insurance to help cure their emphysema or whatever. And so we're going to be in a disastrous situation. The worst city? Boston, Massachusetts.
Why?
For all the reasons that I indicated, just percent of households without air conditioning, ground level ozone contamination, and households below poverty line. So
slowly north of us.
But Massachusetts, yeah, and they're actually further north than we are. Massachusetts and Boston, they have plans in place to give help and support to the people that need it when these heat waves hit. So they're better structured to take care of that problem when it comes up. So we've got a ways to go. Last idea, which a lot of people out there want to know, is that a great commentator, Tom Hartmann, that's T-H-O-M, Hartmann, H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, he's a liberal progressive radio talk show host.
And he's a handicapped guy.
You can go to his...
Isn't he?
I don't know. I didn't see him in a wheelchair, but...
I
listened to his show online, and he has this idea that attracted me to him. Want to stimulate the economy? Lower the retirement age to 55 now.
Yeah. What will that do?
Oh, it'll open up a lot of jobs for the people out of work.
Who's going to pay the guys that are 55 and don't have a
job? Well, the government would, yeah. But the point is, it's going to be a lot less expensive, and the